Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book. Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network, and I'm very happy today to say that we are talking with David Kettler and Thomas Wheatland about their terrific book, Learning from Franz L. Neumann, Law, Theory, and the Brute Facts of Political Life. If you want to know anything about Neumann, I very highly recommend this book to you because it has pretty much everything you could ever want about Neumann, who was a very significant figure, and I'm sure we'll talk about that in the course of the interview. So let me turn to you guys and say thank you for being on.
Well, pleasure.
Pleasure, Marshall. Thanks for having us.
Sure. Maybe we could begin the interview by having David tell us a little bit about himself and his interactions with Neumann.
I'm the very much senior in chronology and a partner here. I was born in 1930 in Leipzig in Germany. My family managed through a series of happy accidents and coincidences to flee. We left on the last boat out of Italy, the Conte di Savoia, in 1940. My father died at age 35, a month after we arrived in the United States. That's a little autobiographical note, which plays a part, I imagine, and lots of what I've done and what I've neglected to do over the years. I'll jump to that. I went to Columbia College. I lived in New York City. My mother had remarried, and we lived in Jersey City. And so I was a commuter from Jersey City to New York for Columbia College. I took a political theory course in my second year there and decided that this is what I wanted to do. And so I finished undergraduate school in 3 years, thanks to a benign peculiarities of the Columbia grading system at the time. And I then went on to graduate school. And my first encounter with Franz Neumann was in what had been actually one of the two summer classes that I took, finished the undergraduate degree. So I was in a large lecture class with this very strong, powerful figure with a very thick German accent, whom we all almost immediately, we heard about him, he'd had the reputation, and so we came to pay very close attention. And then I finished my coursework for the PhD in 1954. By then I was married, had a child. I took a year, I had a Rockefeller grant to begin my dissertation research, which was completely unexpectedly by me on the Scottish moral philosopher named Adam Ferguson, of whom I'd never heard before Franz Neumann picked up or put down his New York Times, looked at me and said, Franz, Adam Ferguson picked up this paper again. And so there I went off to do that. And that dissertation took me a while. You have to cut me short because I'm a talker.
Oh, please go ahead. Please. They want to hear from you, not me.
Okay. So let me then just quickly say that Neumann was a key presence in my graduate work. I did do work with the sociologist at Columbia at that time, Robert Merton and all those other people of a generation that were quite well known at the time, but the seminars were all with Franz Neumann, and they all involved, you know, scholarly efforts of a kind that were more demanding and more incomplete than I had expected to do in what I had done in undergraduate school. And after a year's leave or this research leave in 54-55, I was able to get a job at Ohio State University. I had some kind of a short-term, I interviewed in some of the Nazir colleges, and they very wisely at that time didn't hire me, and Ohio State turned out to be just right, in as much as I then came under the practical coaching of Harvey Mansfield, who was not a political theorist at all, but who had respect and who was patient with me, and I worked for him as the assistant to the editor of the Political Science Review for 6 years, reading every submission to the New York, to the Political Science Review, which was 10 articles a week that I read and commented on and we met and discussed. So I had a training in political science that I had disregarded as my, in my university schooling. In 1970, I accepted an appointment elsewhere, which then fell through because I was denounced as a dangerous radical. The aftermath of the student demonstrations of that spring. And so I was effectively blacklisted and I would get indications of jobs and then they would all disappear. I ended up working for a 23-year-old college president named Bob Stein at Little College in New England. And I worked for him for a year before I was able to get a position in Canada, where I then taught political theory for 20 years at Trent University in Canada with good colleagues. So that's how it goes. I then retired there at age 60, in part because we had spent a year here at Bard College the year before on the sabbatical, where the same 32-year-old college was by now a lot older than that. And so she'd gotten a job here, and so I took a retirement at 60. And I've been here. I retired finally here last July 1st on my 89th birthday.
Wow.
So that's been the academic career. My work, I want to say something about that very quickly, just touch the topic. The work on Ferguson raised a set of issues about intellectuals as distinct from philosophers that I then needed to pursue. I went then to a number of years of work on Carl Mannheim and on the whole literature of Mannheim. When I was at Trent University, I organized the faculty in a union that got me interested in problems of law and labor, so I did some work in that field and published some writings in that area. And then I think, well, I'll skip a few things because I mean, the Mannheim things got quite extended and long. And I then went to the problem of the exiles, now the exile generation, and did organize a lot of group research projects that generated 3, 4, 5 books that we did on the question of the 1930 exile, which of course brought me back to Neumann, who I'd simply been waiting to be ready for. And I met Tom then at one of these conferences and found that he had a balance in background, that he knew a lot about the Frankfurt School period, had written just a very good book on this. And so we had worked over the years, each in our own fields, but also on this common project that we're now discussing. So I don't know, I must have skipped some things, but that's the overview. And so here I am, about to celebrate my 90th birthday. And what I'm doing right now is, well, I'll tell you about that later.
Okay, great. Bye-bye. Thank you very much. It's quite a life, I have to say. That's quite a remarkable life. Tom, could you say a little bit about yourself?
Sure, Marshall, thanks. So I'm an intellectual history, a German intellectual history by training. I did my undergraduate studies at Brown University, where Mary Gluck was the scholar who exposed me to the field, very thankfully. And then I went on to graduate school at Boston College, where my mentor was Paul Brynäs. And my first book was entitled The Frankfurt School in Exile. And that was, I mean, in some ways it was a reception history, but also a reevaluation of the history of critical theory in light of the exile experience. And a lot of what I wanted to demonstrate in that work were all of the really substantive connections that the figures of the Horkheimer Circle or Frankfurt School had with intellectuals and networks of intellectuals within the United States. So part of the reason that I came to this project is because for that dissertation, which then became my first book, you know, I mean, Franz Neumann was someone who I had read and studied, and in fact, I had gone down to the National Archives to look at some of the files related to the work that he had done with the Office of Strategic Services, together with Herbert Marcuse and Otto Kirchheimer during the Second World War, and it ultimately proved to be too difficult and awkward to kind of crowbar that material into that first project. And so when David approached me, so David and I met through a conference that he held at Bard right around the time that I finished and defended my dissertation, called Contested Legacies. And so I came to the conference and I talked a little bit about Paul Lazarsfeld and his relationship to the Frankfurt School, so just like one little teeny case study. And David and I got to know one another. We edited a special edition of a journal that included several papers from that conference. And then when he approached me right at the time that I was, in fact, publishing The Frankfurt School in Exile, and mentioned this idea of doing a book on Franz Neumann, I was really excited about the idea. You know, Neumann was one of the people I was particularly intrigued by, but really felt as though I'd had to largely exclude him. And so this was a wonderful opportunity to be able to explore him in much greater detail, probably more detail than I'd ever imagined at the moment of its inception. And certainly I had no idea that I would need to become as familiar and comfortable with the sociology of law as became necessary. But that's how I came to the project.
Terrific. Could one of you, and I won't pick, just tell the listeners briefly, and this will sound like a ridiculous question, who Franz Neumann was? Who wants
Shall
to go?
Do it, Tom?
Sure. Do you want to go, David, or do you want me to?
Well, why don't you? Because I ramble on
sure.
too much.
Okay, no, that's fine.
Yes. Go ahead, Tom.
So Franz Neumann was born right at the turn of the century, 1900, in Silesia. He went off to university and became embroiled in the November Revolution of 1918, as a lot of other people from his generation. And that then brought him into the world of labor politics. And that then soon morphed into a career in labor law. Now, one of the things that we spend some time talking a little bit about in the book is how sort of awkward the position of particularly lawyers in the entire Marxian intellectual tradition is, you know, like what a fraught position that is. But that is, in fact, what he spent really the first half of his life doing. So he worked as a representative of some of the biggest labor unions in the Weimar Republic, and then in fact did a lot of work for the Social Democratic Party in some of the most intensely fraught years at the end of the Weimar Republic. And then, of course, when the Nazis came to power, he was identified very early on as one of their political enemies, and so he was briefly interned in a concentration camp and then fled the country as soon as he had the opportunity, and did a brief period of exile in Britain, where he got a second doctoral degree, this time not in law. So, you know, I mean, it is interesting that he chose to no longer continue as a practicing attorney. Instead, he began a second doctoral education in political theory with Harold Laski at the London School of Economics. And there he also studied with Morris Ginsburg and with Carl Mannheim. He completed that doctoral dissertation and then had the opportunity to travel with Laski to the United States to presumably meet with people about potential job prospects. And part of his part of the way that he was able to clear a visa to get over to the United States and stay here for as long as he did is that he and Laski had contacts with the Institute for Social Research and Max Horkheimer, who at this time were based in New York. And so Horkheimer sort of professionally vouched for Neumann and said that Neumann was doing work for the Institute, which he was, in fact, doing to promote the interests of the Institute in the UK. And so he came over here. The job prospects in America didn't really pan out, but his relationship with Horkheimer grew, although maybe not in the way that Neumann would have preferred. So initially what he was doing was a lot of actually lawyerly work, handling a really ugly lawsuit that the main benefactor of the Institute, Felix Weil, was having with his brother-in-law in Argentina. And then he was also doing work on behalf of the Institute, trying to rescue its library from the Nazis and enlisting the help of the British government to do that. But that then became, I mean, he was able to parlay that into a career as I wouldn't say that he was certainly one of the closest associates of the Horkheimer circle, but a somewhat distant associate of the Horkheimer circle. What he was doing was certainly related to what they were doing, but we may have an opportunity to talk about that a little bit later. There were also things that he was... I'm sorry?
Just to interrupt for a second. I mean, the image that I more likely to use that Tom... is he was a bargaining partner, he was a negotiating partner at the Institute. That is, and that's a complicated but important role, and they did strike terrific deals, as well as some cases where they agreed to maintain distance. Is that
yes. I would say
that's
absolutely.
That sorry.
Yeah. Yes. And then, ultimately, partly as a result of some of the successes that, and through bargaining that he brought to them, they sort of unceremoniously parted professional company with him, and that's the moment that he started working full time with the OSS out of Washington, D.C., which he then did until the end of the war, at which point he was able to make a fairly smooth transition to Columbia University, which is where he taught until the end of his life in 1954, when he died very prematurely in a tragic car accident in Switzerland. So that is a fairly quick, abbreviated biography.
Mm-hmm. David, do you have anything you want to add to that?
No, I mean, I think that the overlap between his experience as a labor lawyer, where a primary mode of interaction is a negotiated relationship, into that developed strength that he had, and that's a pattern that follows, so that his relation with Harold Laski has some of that character, and with the group there, I mean, he'll quote Carl Mannheim, but he certainly is not about to go to bed with Carl Mannheim, but he was somebody who was able to learn and teach, and so when we call the book subtitle it, or call it Learning from Franz Neumann, we have a non-passive notion of what learning means. I mean, Neumann learned from a great many people, and he taught a great many people. So that kind of a learning relationship, which is a reciprocal relationship, which involves critical distance, which involves recognition of imperfections, but which generates a kind of a shared role or shared institution. And that seems to us, or at least when we were thinking about the title of the book, that sense of learning, which is not a passive thing, is a quality of his work and his relationship with Marx, and relationship with Hegel, and his relationship with a great many legal theorists. And so when he engages these lengthy treatments, detailed treatments of Montesquieu or whoever it might be, it always has that quality to it, that you're watching somebody in a process of exchange and of learning, which is why, at least, you know, it's why we think he's such a valuable person to take in some detail, to follow that process as he learns, as we learn from him learning. I'm sorry, I don't want to make that a cliche, but I think that notion, that kind of a bargaining relationship that takes place in a terrific classroom is where the best student is not the most abject subject of his teacher mm-hmm. or hers. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
It does. I want to go to the kind of early moment in his life, and I don't know, maybe I just hang out with the wrong people, but most of the lawyers I know don't have any sort of relationship with Marx or Hegel or anybody who writes any theory. And then most of the political theorists that I know, and I'm a Russian historian, so I know a little bit about Russian political theorists, especially, you know, Lenin and so on, they don't have any relationship to actually, well, work. and I don't think Lenin ever worked a day in his life. But, well, that's probably unfair. But you see what I'm saying? So Neumann is interesting in the sense that he was theoretically minded, but he also worked as a lawyer. Can you talk a little bit about how these two things interacted? My lawyer never mentions Marx or Hegel or anybody.
I would say that as both a legal theorist and a political theorist, that what Neumann really did was he practiced a kind of sociology of political theory and of law. So he's always balancing, whether it's legal theory or it's political theory, he's always balancing them against a historical analysis of that theory in its immediate context. So, you know, when addressing any kind of theoretical legal problem, you know, he's looking at how that problem and how that theory operate at a given historical moment in time, and he's really using a very rigorous sociological mode of analysis to look at them in relation to that. And so, you know, what that equips him to be able to do is to be able to evaluate these theories in their material context and to be able to assess how rationally they correspond to the material circumstances of the world at a given moment. But, you know, I do want to pass this on to David, because this is a topic that is near and dear to him.
Okay, David, go ahead.
No, I think that the the concept of his conception of how power works, you know, what are the resources of power, and how does one have an impact in the world of power, which shaped so much, that brings together the idea that you can't possibly be a lawyer given the problematic, you know, the kind of struggle for a measure of power on the part of the labor movement without same time, being able to reflect on that. That comes from the beginning in his first doctoral dissertation. He's, you know, immediately concerned with those issues. So I think that one way of, you know, thinking about it is that it's to distinguish it from the other people that you had in mind, is that it really is the idea, his recognition of the legal structure, of the legal system, as a very important reference point for the structures and operations of power in the society.
So what were Neumann's politics in the 20s? He was a member of the SPD. He was a socialist. But was he a Marxist? How did that affect the way that he looked at law? Because I know that, you know, from the standard Marxist viewpoint is that all law in the present conditions, that is under capitalism, is bourgeois law. And I'm not sure how you work within bourgeois law. And also the other thing that was interesting to me is that I think from the stereotypical Marxist point of view, that negotiating for labor unions is a kind of revisionism of the Bernsteinian sort. Am I wrong about that? Anyway, could one of you talk about that?
You want to go first, well, David, or do you want me?
Well, why don't you begin, and then all the rest of it, yeah.
Well, I think the design that Neumann works within is one that had been really pioneered by Sinsheimer, who was one of Neumann's mentors. So the idea with the formulation of the Weimar Constitution is that, you know, that was merely a political constitution, but that constitution would grow and evolve into a social constitution through the collective bargaining carried out by unions and their labor lawyers. So I think from Neumann's standpoint, he was contributing to that evolving and socialization then of both Weimar politics as well as Weimar society. Is it different from Marx? To some degree it is. It's certainly different from Engels and from Kautsky. He was by no means alone in this project. And so, you know, I think for a good portion of his early career, he was seeing the fruits of all of that. And certainly during the golden years of Weimar, so now we're talking, you know, in the wake of the hyperinflation up to the crash of 1929, you know, there was a lot that he could point to that had been achieved on behalf of labor lawyers like himself and on behalf of the organized labor movement and the Social Democratic Party. I think in light of what happens during the Great Depression, all of this then gets re-exposed to historical and sociological revision. And that's really the moment in time when, you know, he in retrospect thinks, well, you know, maybe some of this was built on some faulty assumptions. So I would say, you know, he was Marxist as an analyst and as a theorist all the way along. But, you know, Marxism, when it comes to the topic of labor law, as you point out, that is a slightly awkward fit. But you know, Weimar was an unusual legal and political settlement in some ways.
So if I could just jump in, he was what we would call I would call it an evolutionary socialist. He did not want to take Berlin and institute the People's Republic.
I would say in his early career, that's absolutely true. I mean, there's moments where he questions that, and what would you say, David?
I think it's for him a learning process, this relationship, in the book we have a chapter on Marxism and law, and we try to explore his relationship to both with the, you know, starting out with what I think was his a constant motif for him, that one of the modes of power, one of the ways in which power was structured and manifested and struggled over was in these legal forms. And then the question of whether you could simply dispense with law and somehow break through directly was simply not, from his standpoint, a politically realistic understanding. So that the whole question about Marxism as the analysis of the social processes at work, but then the dispute within Marxism, and indeed Marx's own alternate views and the tension, as Tom just pointed out, between Lenin and other Marxists, Engels and other Marxists on just this issue. I mean, that is part of where he starts out. So the law is a mode of power. It's a place where these, you can't dispense with that dimension without, if you're engaged in some kind of cumulative political transformative process. But I don't think, you know, we then came, and the interesting place to look then at in Neumann, and we then come to that later when he comes to England, before he writes his second more academically controlled dissertation, he actually writes anonymous or pseudonymous writings criticizing the strategies that he himself, he denounces Franz Neumann, among others, for their excessive trust in that accumulation of socio-legal development. But, you know, that was, the man is somebody who, when you have to have a big fat book with a lot of details, precisely because he was always learning himself. And so they take very great distance from it and try to generalize it. You get a textbook thing, and it's of no use. So I think, I mean, he has some terrifically important insights into the way in which political power works in relation to the legal system, and consequently, how, if one wants to transmute the direction and purpose and a design of political power, one has to also interact in some way with the legal order. But he wasn't comfortable as he was in terms of the Social Democratic Party, he was in the center. But he had his own strategy that didn't emerge more clearly until he learned more.
Tom, yeah, did you want to jump in there?
I wanted to just follow up with one thing, and I think that is one thing that really distinguishes this book from virtually everything else that's ever been written about Neumann, is that for the most part, people look at particular moments in Neumann's life and works associated with those moments, and what they fail to capture then is that there's a huge difference between the young Neumann and the old Neumann. There's also, I would say, there's an even sharper difference between the Neumann in England that David just described, who's actually condemning his earlier self, than there is almost at any other moment in his life. And one of the things that it certainly makes me powerfully appreciative of, that, you know, even though my first book was on the theme of exile, is just how totally confusing these times were that he lived through, and how, viewed from the vantage point of exile, you know, his thought is capturing all of that nuance and complexity as he's constantly processing and reprocessing all of these dizzying events that he's seeing develop right before his eyes. I mean, we're living in a similarly confusing moment right now. I can really appreciate, you know, the challenges that he was grappling with.
So if we could move forward just a little bit. Now, he's associated with the SPD, and when the Nazis come to power, he's on their blacklist, and he opts to leave. Why did he opt to leave exactly?
I think he feared further political reprisals. I mean, he did get detained and locked up, and I think there was a very real threat. Threat to his life, his health, being in prison for potentially a very long period of time. He's certainly could have followed other members of the SPD East. I mean, there was a robust community in Prague that he could have joined, but he opted to go to Britain. And I think that some of that had to do with the attraction that Lasky held for him and the possibilities that Lasky offered. So some of that attraction was intellectual. Some of it was obviously material as well. But I think that is what conditioned that choice.
David?
I mean, again, I realize that it's a danger to sort of get everything too flat and smooth. But, you know, he really realized he needed to learn more about power than his confrontation. I mean, the critique at that point, but it is cumulative. He doesn't simply throw everything he had done before away, but you know, he is working against brute facts of political life.
Mm-hmm.
If you read him at the very end, you don't know that he really has a hell of a lot of faith in socialist development at that point anymore, simply because of brute facts of political life. And so the interplay between Neumann's design, and in that sense, consistent design to, you know, for a social change, for social development, and the enormously powerful forces operative that render calculations wrong. And so you have to recalculate, and you have to recalculate, you have to relearn. And so he goes to the Institute as well, not just because it happens to be an opportunity, but he engages very actively in the debates of the Institute, even though he reserves the outcomes of those involvements to himself so that he has another independent basis. But he's always involved. He's involved in other people's research projects. He's involved in trying to... So there is that kind of teaching-learning process that I had mentioned earlier as a feature of his work. I don't know if that... You know, it's really difficult to be very clear about...
Yeah, no, that answers the question.
But he is a socialist. And yet, at the end, I don't think he thinks the prospects for socialism are very good.
Yeah.
And there's a real sense of pessimism, and he's struggling against this Epicurean side, which maybe I exaggerate a bit. And Tom and I have tugged and pulled at some of these things, which is what productive collaboration consists of. I'm struck by his tough mind, his realism. There has to always be something possible to do, but the possibilities are not shaped by your designs or by your wishes.
True. We see that right now, don't we?
That's why I think that we should get a lot of people reading this work, even if they have to struggle a bit during the long chapters on his theory.
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about the book that I think made his name among American academics. It's the only book by him that I knew anything about, and that is Behemoth. Can you, one of you, talk a little bit about the origins of that book, why he wrote it, and what he says in it? And I have a first question. Was it written in German first and then translated, or did he write it in English? I don't know.
Good question. I don't know the answer.
Okay, go ahead. Yeah, it doesn't really matter. I just thought it was amazing.
I mean, it's not brilliant English.
Okay.
I'm very brilliant thinking.
Yeah, right. So why did he write the book, and what does he say in it?
Well, I mean, the interesting thing, and I certainly want to hit Tom on this too, is, you know, it has to do with the dynamics of his relation with the Institute. And so he exposed at various times that the Institute engage in work on the labor history themes in Germany, labor power, and the critique of it. And those projects never came through, partly because of resistance within the Institute, partly tactical resistance to being identified with labor themes, partly because of their own consensus within the Institute that labor was not the relevant variable or the decisive variable anymore. And so what he managed to do, but he was on the edge of being ousted from the Institute, but he wasn't yet. But he did manage to negotiate with Horkheimer a kind of authority to write an independent book, to make a contract with the, and to develop the argument about the National Socialist regime and its relation to this labor motif that the Institute itself is not prepared to back. So, you know, that was then a very important work for him. It was the culmination to a point of his understanding of what he had learned about this regime. And it was done then, and it has this interesting tense relationship with the Institute thinking about these matters, and indeed the Institute thinking about what was happening in the world of the economy. But I don't know if we have time to get into that.
Tom, did you want to say something?
Yeah, I wanted to add that I think so. Neumann's timing with this project is, and I would say in some ways his fortunes with the Institute are dramatically affected by the fact that. So I would say that at the same moment that Neumann's star begins to wane, and I would also add a little bit before that, Erich Fromm's star not only waned but shot out. It's at the same moment that Adorno is sort of rising ascendant in the Institute. So, you know, there had been a plan to pursue a project that was largely Neumann's design to do a kind of sociological structural analysis of the rise of Nazism that would have very prominently featured labor and the rise of German cartels as sort of the opposing force that ultimately winds up eclipsing all. And then very rapidly, with Adorno's ascendancy in the Institute, the whole focus of that project very rapidly shifts to a focus on a crisis of German culture. And not only did that trouble Neumann, but it really became profoundly unattractive to the United States sponsors of that project. So Eugene Anderson, who was the main point person for the Institute, who is American, who is trying to facilitate a successful grant with the Rockefeller Foundation. He was very troubled by this and thought that this angle would be an absolute non-starter. And then, of course, the Rockefeller Foundation, much to Neumann's, no surprise on his part, nor any surprise to Eugene Anderson, that was precisely their take on it. So I think Behemoth was his opportunity to actually fulfill exactly the design that he'd intended to carry out. And yeah, David's right. There is a way in which that follows up on a lot of the work that he'd already done in the London dissertation that he'd done with Lasky, as well as, I would say, the really significant article that he wrote for the Institute's journal. So it's building on top of all of that. And, if you look at the American reviews of Behemoth, those scholars in America who were able to appreciate its theoretical standpoint certainly did, but I would say that the majority of scholars who who read and applauded Behemoth were not able to really fully appreciate its theoretical grounding, and instead what they were largely praising was just all of the empirical data that he assembled, you know, to, I would say, for the moment that he's writing it. We're talking, you know, it comes out in 1942 for the first time. You know, it was unparalleled in terms of the amount of German source material that it was bringing to bear on its analysis of Nazism. And it's actually presenting a fairly, I think to a lot of Americans, what would have been a very surprising conclusion about all of that, you know, which is to say that far from being a totalitarian state or an authoritarian state, that really Nazi Germany is it's a non-state. It's a failed state, and it's a state in which the rule of law is being actively subverted by these various groups. You know, so it's not the Nazi Party that's running the whole thing. That was actually, when he entered OSS, that was their understanding within OSS of how the Nazi state operated. I think by the time Neumann became involved, and I think he actually contributed a lot to changing OSS's thinking on this. Now it's actually, you know, there are these these various groups. The Nazi Party is one of several groups. You also have the military, you have the bureaucracy, and of course you have the business community. They all have different interests, but their interests do overlap in enough ways that they are able, at least at the moment that he's talking about it, to cooperate to a degree. You know, the question going forward is to what extent is that cooperation going to continue? To what extent may some of them be conquered by others in all of this? But yeah, that's what I wanted to add.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's also, you know, to attempt to explain why the war, why the expansionist drive was, you know, the thesis being that was a way in which this discordant elements could be made to sing one song.
Yeah.
Because there was something in it for each of them, or some grand thing in it for each of them. But the question of how they would even deal with a victory, quite apart from the realities that they would be facing, was, you know, that's part of the puzzle, the problem of Behemoth. So, you know, I think but that was a vision that, as you said, Tom, I went also through all the reviews of that book, and they sort of simply saying, oh, well, there's this Marxist stuff, and they just push that aside. But I think the fact that they were being introduced to power factors in reading this book that had been somehow put aside in the dramatization of the Nazi regime, of its party activity, was, you know, made it such a powerful contribution. Anyway, I think your audience is going to get tired of our voices.
I don't know. I'm not quite done yet. I don't know our audience,
okay,
but
well,
I'm interested.
But I will stop. You know, it's just that you can see we really still have unfinished business with this guy.
Sure.
And I, that's where we should be even after 40, 30, 20 years.
Yeah, I would maybe we'll close with this question, then you guys can discuss this, because I'm just very interested personally in, well, how to put it best. So, on the plus side, Neumann proved to be a very good American in a way. I mean, he was very good to the authorities. Worked for the OSS, and then later he, if I'm not incorrect, he goes on and he works at Nuremberg for the War Crimes Tribunal and such. So that, you know, obviously that, you know, most Americans would consider that a good thing. But on the other hand, you know, he is a Marxist and a socialist. I just wonder what did he think about the Soviet Union, and did he have dealings with the Soviet Union, and, you know, that sort of thing. Can you talk a little bit about that? I don't know, but go ahead.
Well, let me just try very quickly. I think that, you know, I think he found the Soviet Union as another one of these unwanted, one of these brute interventions. Nevertheless, that there was something behind it that he was not, that, you know, this Soviet Union was interesting to him from the standpoint of its enemies. And so the Soviet, so that he was never pro-Soviet or indeed at all. I mean, his liberal democratic commitments were pretty firm. But I think that the question was not simply being pro-Soviet, but being in some measure anti-Soviet. Because he looked at what were the major forces of the anti-Soviet side of the play. So I think that he had that kind of a more complicated relationship to it, although certainly by the time he's teaching courses at Columbia, he's teaching us about totalitarianism. Mm-hmm. And by then, he's got the Soviets clearly in that compartment. But I think it is a more. It was always a complicated relationship because it was an accident on the way to going someplace where it would be the right place to go.
Right.
For him.
Right.
Is that right, Tom?
Yeah, I would agree. And I think, you know, one of the things that we maybe haven't touched on enough is the concept of freedom for Neumann. I mean, I think for him, you know, the reason for studying law and upholding the rule of law and the reason for studying political theory, I mean, I would say, you know, if there's something for me, at least, that cuts right down to the essence of what he stood for, he wrote, "The truth of political theory is political freedom," and I think that for him that was so. You know, was there initially promise with the Bolshevik Revolution? Yeah, to some degree, and then a whole series of incredibly bad turns took place. And I think, you know, by any measure, you know, the appalling lack of freedom was something that always really troubled him. But was there the potential that those mistakes could be overcome? I think that was the possibility that he never wanted to completely foreclose. So, you know, I mean, he was patient and hopeful that things had the potential to change. And I think he certainly recognized, you know, that a lot of what what Lenin contributed and Stalin contributed were incredibly misguided. And yet, you know, I mean, I think some of that he also identified, you know, Russia's circumstances being very different from Germany's circumstances. So, I mean, in that sense, you know, he was also very particularist with regard to these places. But yeah, you know, I mean, certainly if you look at some of his analyses of the East German regime, you know, now we're talking like 1950, you know, he's not terribly happy with either the policies being carried out by East German authorities with regard to questions of democratization or denazification, you know, two things that he heartily thought needed to be carried out with regard to post-war Germany. But he also thought that for very different reasons, you know, the policies that were unfolding in West Germany didn't go as far and didn't accomplish as much as he would have liked either. So, I think when it comes to the Cold War, you know, I mean, he didn't live long enough to see it fully develop and fully blossom. But I think he was very disappointed. I think, you know, if you look at his contributions to OSS, he really thought that there was an opportunity that was missed, that that for there to be a truly positive potential for Europe's post-war development, it necessitated a cooperation and an understanding between the United States and the Soviet Union that just never materialized. So I think that was another contribution to his profound pessimism toward the end of his life.
Well, I would say he was hardly alone in continuing to hold the candle of hope for the Soviet Union. I think many of the listeners to this podcast will know that Eric Hobsbawm and E.P. Thompson were doing it in the 80s. So it's not that unusual. So we've taken up a lot of your time, and I very much appreciate it. Let me close the interview by asking the traditional final question on the New Books Network, and we'll start with David. David, what are you working on now?
Well, I'm actually I'm doing some translation work. We compiled 2 volumes of studies. Developing a thesis about the exile, about the immigration, or an insight into the immigration of that generation that had to do with what I called the first letters, which had to do with how the exiles responded to first letters from people they had known who had remained in Germany, or the other way. And so this theme of first letters turns out to have been quite a productive way of thinking about the exile and their understanding of the world and also the role they played. And so we put out 2-volume collected works so I'm just right now doing work that's appropriate to my age. I spend 3-4 hours a day doing translation of texts that various people had written, which also fosters me reflecting some more on that whole set of issues. So at the moment I'm compelled to be fairly realistic about tackling whole new areas of research or projects.
Well, it sounds absolutely fascinating. I should say that I'm 58 now, and I've written a number of books and many, many articles. And I look back on what I've written, my bibliography and so on and so forth, and all I can think is if somebody just looked at it and then tried to deduce why I did things on the basis of what I had written, they would get it entirely wrong. Entirely, if they didn't have access to like my email account. If they had that, then they might actually render a decent description of my life. But without that, it would be impossible just by looking at what I've actually published. So I think it sounds like a fascinating project. Tom?
So I have been furiously writing lots and lots of book reviews lately as I'm contemplating. I'm really trying to decide between 2 book projects because...
Okay, we'll decide right now. I'll decide for you.
Yeah, so you can decide for me, Marshall. This is perfect. One is a very short book that a publisher approached me to write that would be kind of a reintroducing Eric Frome to advanced undergraduates and graduate students in the social sciences, and I think especially in sociology and history. And so that would be very, very short, like maybe 50,000-60,000 words. And that is appealing for various reasons. But then there's another part of me that's torn by the idea of doing a really massive public intellectual contribution, focusing on the history of fear or anxiety as an intellectual construct, and looking at the history of that idea over a very, very long period of time operative in Western civilization. So they're 2 very different projects that would yield 2 very different results. And part of the reason that I'm taking my time to make the decision is because as you both mentioned, I'm getting older, and I recognize that,
you have 2 hands. I mean, you can do one with each. I think the anxiety thing is great because it is a, it was one of Neumann's last realities that he felt he had to confront, and he didn't quite know with what he was learning about it. So it would be an interesting continuation of the
It certainly connects with that. And I also find that it's something that comes up in my teaching endlessly, not so much student anxiety as much as the anxiety of various historic subjects who I tend to focus on in my teaching, both to introductory courses for undergrads as well as advanced electives. So,
I just have to step in here and just editorialize for a second. I mean, one of the things that historians know that nobody else knows, well, I don't know if historians even know it, but I know it, is that when you study history, history is like something that happens to you. It's not, you can't predict these things, and it can almost always be worse. And so when something like the coronavirus happens, You look at yourself, you're like, oh, this is one of those things. And I tell my kids all the time, you'll remember this your whole life. This is like one of those moments. And you don't have very many of them, but this is one of them, and you're in it.
So it's
really kind of an amazing thing, that kind of perspective is that you get by studying history, because this is one of them. We're in one right now. And this isn't even a very big one. Imagine having to uproot your entire family and move to Britain in 1936. That one would be a big one. So anyway, I want to thank both of you guys for being on the show. It's been absolutely fascinating talking to both of you. Let me tell our listeners that we've been talking to David Kettler and Thomas Wheatland about their book, Learning from Franz Neumann, Law, Theory, and the Brute Facts of Political Life. I hope you go out and buy the book. David and Thomas, thanks very much for being on the show.
Thanks for having us, Marshall.
Absolutely. Bye-bye.